Joining me now is Patricia T. O'Connor, who visits our show once a month to talk about the English language and take your calls at 646-829-3985. That's 646-829-3985. Or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. And people do in droves during the show, and then they write to me afterward, and I forward them to you, and you get a lot of stuff on your website.
I do.
Grammophobia.
Yes.
And I gather today you have been thinking a lot about what happened in Tucson because the shooter actually had all sorts of theories about language.
Right. He had a lot of rants about grammar. And grammar conspiracies have always interested me, but they've, of course, been in the news lately because Jared Loughner has said he believes that the government controls our grammar and that this is part of a vast mind control program.
Now, how does a government control grammar? I mean, I know Jared Loughner is the one who should answer
that. Yeah, he's never explained that.
But how do conspiracy theorists talk about that?
Well, he has been linked to a Milwaukee grammar conspiracy theorist named David Wynn Miller, who believes that only nouns have legal standing. So, for example, he argues
that— Does Antonin Scalia know this?
He argues that if you you can avoid taxation by changing your name into a prepositional phrase. And he also believes that, another way to avoid paying taxes is if you can go into court and prove that the word money is a verb instead of a noun, then they can't tax you. So these are, of course, the extreme lunatic fringe of the far-right grammar conspiracy theorists. Of course, Loughner, I don't think we should even grant that he's obviously a sick person. But
I saw something on television, and I think it was on 60 Minutes, interviews with some of his friends. Mm-hmm. And one of the things he engaged in is something that I think every high school junior engages in. Why are we calling this red? It would still be the same color if we called it green or blue or cup or microphone.
And of course he has a point then, but most of us grow out of those kinds of arguments. We don't build conspiracy theories around them. But it's easy to dismiss guys like him, of course, because Loughner and Miller are the extremist wackos. But what concerns me more is that from time to time I get mail from people who aren't wackos but who still see grammar as part of a conspiracy. They're thoughtful people who really believe this, and they make arguments of various forms. For instance, some see standard English as a tool used by the upper classes to keep the masses in their place. Or they might see it as a weapon used by whites against blacks, or by intellectuals versus the less well-educated, or by native-born Americans against immigrants, or by professionals against the working class, and so on.
But don't they even have – isn't there a little validity to that? At least if you look at England in the class system, the upper classes had a different way of speaking than the working class in England, and they made it a point to do that, including weird pronunciations of names that only they would recognize.
Right. It's pronounced, or it's spelled luxury yacht, but it's pronounced throat warbler mangrove.
Right.
Yes. true. But, you know, interestingly, what's happening in England now is that all the upper crust are adopting estuary accents. More working class kind of accents. So that's something different. I think those are just fashions in pronunciation. That's not really imposing your grammar on someone.
So since I grew up very poor in a very bad section of New York, am I a traitor to my class because I've tried to speak correctly?
Well, one of the points I wanted to make is that for instance, you grew up in a poor family. I grew up as part of a working class family. I was the first generation in my family to go to college.
Me too.
So I don't consider myself part of a dominant class or part of the ruling classes or part of the elite. The only advantage I had that I can see is that I had access to a pretty good public education. And, you know, if facility with language and good communication skills, even eloquence, make you part of an elite, well, that's not something that's out of anyone's reach. So I think people who can read and communicate unambiguously in clear English, I mean, if they're an elite class, this is an elite class that anyone can belong to. But the point I want to get across is there are reasonable people out there who feel otherwise. Here's a quote that I found from the person's sex wasn't identified, but he or she is a high school teacher of advanced placement English, literature, and composition, and said on a website, and I quote, "Grammar has and continues to be used as means of establishing power roles. It divides us socially, economically, and culturally by excluding the portions of society that do not speak or write with the same grammar as the ruling class." And this sounds like a very facile argument on the surface. But in fact, where grammar is concerned, there is no ruling class. There's no authority that establishes what rules of usage, pronunciation, spelling are. They're all established by common usage, which is the masses, which is me, you, which is all of us together.
Well, if I received a letter that was addressed to use guys, I would think there was something amiss.
You would. And probably if someone were to address a letter to you that way, you'd assume that it was
a joke.
A joke, of course. Part of communicating is being able to get across the right nuance. And if that person wasn't meaning to make a joke, then he shouldn't address a letter, use guys.
My guest is Patricia T. O'Connor, author of a number of books on the English language. What Was I? You Send Me, Words Fail Me, Origin of the Specious. When she visits us, we take your calls at 646-829-3985, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. Should we address some of the listeners' concerns?
Yes.
Two listeners have written into our show page asking about the use of the word myself. Carol asks about saying, on behalf of so-and-so and myself. It doesn't ever sound quite right to her. Mike and Tribeca asks about James Joyce's use of the phrase, I myself, in the story Araby, saying it sounds redundant.
He says, I myself?
Yeah.
Well,
of course,
point
there's that song, Me, Myself, and I.
Right. No, I myself is perfectly conventional usage because it's myself was often used to refer back to the subject who's already been mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's also used for emphasis.
But when people say, you've reached the Jones household, and if you want to speak to Mary, little Laurie, or myself, leave a message.
Right. I always say that the rule of thumb is that if you can reasonably say I or me instead, you probably shouldn't use myself.
Let's take some calls. We go now to Herb from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hello.
Yes.
Oh, hi. I have a something that I've noticed seems to be changing. Before a noun beginning with a consonant, you use the term an. Like
an apple, a
table.
Uh-huh.
And the word history is bothering me because you say a history, but when they said historical, I always had it as an historical, historical event or something like
right.
that.
Isn't this changing, Pat?
Well, I don't think so. I think that this is Anglophobia. Or Anglophilia.
Well, it's a soft H, and yes, so people say an historic event.
An historic event. If you don't pronounce the H in historic, then it's reasonable that you would say an historic event.
You wouldn't say an history book.
You wouldn't say an history. You wouldn't say an history book. You wouldn't say an historical event. I have a very long article on this usage in my blog. The reason that you find an historical written so many times in English literature is because there have been periods when the H was not pronounced in an accented first syllable. Or, I'm sorry, when the second syllable was accented. Mm-hmm. An unaccented first syllable beginning with H wasn't pronounced, as in hotel.
Mm-hmm.
So they'd say an hotel, an homage. So if you don't pronounce your H's, fine. It's reasonable to use an in front of the word. But if you do, it's ridiculous to use an in front of the word.
So if you say a homage to so-and-so,
yes,
then you have to say but if you say an homage, then you have to say an.
I suppose.
Spell it the same
maybe
way.
You should say in homage. yeah, homage is another one.
I like a homage à toi.
Yeah.
But
the proper pronunciation of that word is either homage or homage in English. Homage is a French word. So it's homage or homage. Whether you pronounce the H or not, the first syllable is accented.
Cy Lasks from Queens. No, from Chelsea. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. My question is about an expression. I grew up in Hell's Kitchen, and they were using these expressions very often. And also, I was surprised to find out that it was on The Sopranos as well in one of their segments. And it is the greeting, "There he is."
And what's wrong with "there he is"?
When someone came into the room, they would say, "There he is." And what's the derivation of that? Is that
it's called the English language, isn't it?
Yes, I can tell you that I grew up in Iowa, and I heard that once in a while. It's just a
there he is,
like voila,
yeah,
or ecco. The Italians say eccola. It's no special expression. It's like sometimes people ask where this business comes from of referring to the father of the house as himself. Where's himself? Where's herself for the mother? That's an old Irishism. But again, there he is. That's it's just a manner of speaking. Call it an English idiom, but I don't think it was confined to Hell's Kitchen or North Jersey.
No. Tim in Brooklyn asks a question that sometimes I ask myself about. He says, I'm curious about he says overuse of the word that. Mm-hmm. I know that I love you, he says, versus I know I love you, mm-hmm. which seems cleaner to him.
Mm-hmm.
There are times when I just wonder whether I should stick that word that in or mm-hmm. or not. And usually it has more to do with the rhythm of the sentence than it has to do with whether one works better or not.
Exactly. There are times when an extra that will help. For instance, if in a very long sentence where you've forgotten what the subject is, you might want to insert another that if your sentence goes on and on. But there's no rule that you either have to include that or you have to exclude it. And it is, as you say, a matter of euphony, how it sounds to your ear.
But people want to have rules. This is something we discuss a lot on this show.
I know.
People want to know you can't use the word that in that sentence.
Again, that's why I said there's no ruling class with English. The grammar is basically just a set of conventions that's evolved over time from common usage.
Janet in Manhattan points out that George Bush belies all the arguments that grandma's rules are being set by the upper class.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a very good point.
We're going to take a little break, and we invite your calls when we come back. Our number here is 646-829-3985, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. My guest is Patricia T. O'Connor, who visits us once a month to talk about the language and to take your calls. She's the author of numerous books. Some people now would say multiple books. Now, that I don't know why that rankles me, but...
It rankles you?
Yeah, multiple sounds weird to me. But,
yeah.
You know, I do say there he is, so... What the heck?
Several. Say several.
That simply mean I love you. Three little words. Oh, what I'd give for that wonderful.
We're back with Patricia T. O'Connor, and we're taking your calls at 646-829-3985, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Or if you don't want to do it during the show, you can ask Pat a question by emailing her directly at mailbox@grammophobia.com. And you can also click on Pat's blog at grammophobia.com. to see a selection of language questions from WNYC's listeners. And you get all sorts of interesting requests.
I do.
You want to talk about one?
I do. I got a request from a listener named Sean, who writes, there are negative prefixed words for which you never hear the standard version. Is chalant a word? I only find nonchalant. Now, this is an interesting question because there is no chalant in English, just the negative form, nonchalant. And the reason is that we borrowed nonchalant from the French, and only the negative form of the word found a home in English. We didn't borrow the positive one. And it was originally defined as calm and casual, deliberately lacking in enthusiasm, or indifferent or unconcerned. But there are other words like this for which either we never adopted the positive form, only the negative, or we once had both and the positive one disappeared. An example is, it's not exactly a positive-negative situation, but overwhelm. Have you ever wondered whether there's a whelm?
Mm-hmm.
Can you be whelmed?
We do say underwhelmed.
Right.
But is that a legitimate word, or is that kind of...
That's a sort of a comic
I was underwhelmed by the experience.
On overwhelmed, right. To whelm, back in the 1200s, that meant to overturn or capsize, and it, as in to whelm a boat or a ship, meant to capsize it.
So overwhelm would be redundant.
Overwhelm, it's an emphatic form of overwhelm, of whelm, because it already means to turn over or capsize. But only the negative, emphatic form survived, at least in ordinary usage.
Well, to some degree, it's because we have other words that are perfectly usable.
Mm-hmm.
We don't need chalant.
Yeah, we don't need whelmed.
Mm-hmm.
Although, interestingly, it still appears in some dictionaries. It's just not used. It's funny. We've got all these unused words sitting around in dictionaries. I guess English is pretty big already.
Well,
so.
There were people like Aldous Huxley and William F. Buckley who were very happy to find those words and use them. Let's go to Chris from Manhattan. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
We're well. And what
good.
About you?
Yes, you are. I thought this was very interesting, the statement that there is no ruling grammar, because I think there has become a kind of a ruling grammar among politicians, which is the kind of language that people learn to speak at an Ivy League law school.
Well, if you're talking about specifically legal terminology, there are a lot of fields where you have to use certain vocabulary in order to get across to your peers what you're talking about, like medicine.
I think Chris is talking about the difference between someone like Hillary Clinton and Sarah Palin.
That's exactly what I meant.
Oh, I see.
When you hear people like Hillary Clinton or Al Gore being interviewed, they can talk a sentence that is probably 60 or 70 words, mm-hmm. three or four dependent clauses, and they can keep all the predicates lined up.
Right, but I mean,
and what's interesting, and I think you learn that in an Ivy League graduate school, where mm-hmm. you're taught to develop that kind of thinking.
It's but, true. In graduate school, you are basically taught how to be long-winded and use bigger words than necessary. But I don't think that that grammar is being imposed on the rest of us. See,
no,
so I don't
what,
think that's a ruling class sort of
but
grammar.
Isn't it sort of our version of what the Queen's English was in Britain, where people could judge a social class by the way the language was spoken?
I think what's the problem with your argument here is that in many cases people choose to speak in a certain way. I suspect Sarah Palin is choosing to use certain kinds of metaphors and similes and dropping G's. Everybody drops G's. Hillary Clinton dropped her G's like mad when she was running for president. Barack Obama drops them as well.
Mm-hmm.
These are all ways of saying to people,
I'm just
like you.
Right, I'm just focused.
And Sarah Palin is making a point in the way that she speaks, just as and Hillary Clinton could not do that because she's working on a diplomatic level right now. But if she were running for president as just one of us regular folks, she might very well adopt a different style.
Uh-huh. But don't you think, have you noticed that Sarah Palin in the last year has gotten much better at giving answers that are fairly lengthy and have lots of dependent clauses in them? I think she's actually a pretty quick study.
I don't know. When she uses phrases like blood libel, she's causing more trouble than it's worth.
Yeah,
I'm talking about her ability to compose in her head a fairly complicated sentence, which a year ago she couldn't do, but she is definitely doing it now.
I don't see any evidence of that, and I think most of the statements I read by her or from her office are probably written by a spokesperson. I haven't seen her thinking on her feet. Have you?
Oh, well, we're moving on.
Okay, right.
But I think that the points are well taken.
Yeah.
And people are going to have to decide for themselves, as they mm-hmm. do whenever we discuss
right.
politicians. Amy in Manhattan wonders if it's ever okay to use two thats in a row, for example.
Of course.
I know that that is not true.
That is, mm-hmm. That is not. Yeah, exactly, because that has different functions. It's a very flexible word. It can be a subject of a sentence. And it can be an object. It's not unusual to have two thats in a row.
And then Andrew from the West Village wants to add to this. Andrew?
Hi. Boy, you guys sparked so many things in my head. Speaking of that...
I hope there's no fire going on.
Well, I just could stay on the line for too long. Back in Catholic school, the nuns frightened me into believing that is for things and who is for people. And nowadays I hear so much, I'm looking for a person that can help me.
Mm-hmm.
Am I correct?
Well, that's never been true. I have researched that and it has never been true.
Oh, really?
Yes.
So
that was just something the nuns in his school were perpetrating?
They were the ruling class in that particular school. Yes.
They made me believe a lot of things.
But there's no grammatical foundation for that. A lot of people seem to believe that there's a politeness issue, that is for objects and who is for humans. But it's
wow.
It's not,
well,
not
thank
a,
you. It's the
not
only thing the nuns got wrong,
sound.
Andrew. Everything else they told you was true.
I can let that go. Can I ask two more things quickly? Or
one more thing.
Okay. Which, even I am turned around with which. People say, and please help me with this,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to the store, which I don't know what I'm going to buy.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
That sounds wrong to me, and I can't nail it, and I wish you would help us with the which.
That sounds like you just need a but in there. I'm going to the store, but I don't know what I'm going to buy. That usage is foreign to me. But if you're talking about the kind of usage where you say...
shouldn't something be established by the time you say which?
Yes.
And then you don't
if
have
you
to
use
reiterate.
The which to refer back to something that you can think of as a noun phrase, fine.
I would think I'm going to the store, which is a problem right now because
yes.
I'm not sure.
Yes.
Yeah, actually, I'm wrong. It doesn't have to be a noun phrase. You can say he skis well, which is fortunate for mm-hmm. his
right.
family because they get to go on ski vacations. So, right. But in the example you cited, it wasn't a good referent.
Thank you for calling us, Andrew. I was thinking, because Amy asked about the double that,
mm-hmm.
about our inclination to not repeat a word in a paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is a strong rhetorical
right.
tradition saying
right.
the same word again and again.
Right.
But I know when I write, if I've just said Detroit, the next time I want to say the Motor City.
Uh-huh. Well, that actually,
I don't
when
say Detroit,
I was
Detroit, Detroit.
Back when I was an editor at the New York Times, there was a word for that. It was called the slender yellow fruit syndrome. And that is where you're confronted with a piece of writing in which you say, Felix was offered an orange and a banana, and he selected the slender yellow fruit. right.
In that
There's
case,
no
you
crime.
Do have to say banana.
There's no crime in repeating a word once in a while. But sometimes it sounds better not to.
Mm. Well, sometimes it just sounds like you have a very limited vocabulary.
Right.
Susan in Yorktown Heights writes, a pundit discussing the shooting in Arizona last week said that the situation was incredulous. Can a situation be incredulous?
No, that's an increasingly common mistake. The situation is incredible, I suppose, and a person is incredulous. Incredulous describes a person's state.
Can you put it in a sentence?
I was incredulous when he told me that this cafe latte cost $6.50.
Mm-hmm. Mary in Staten Island writes, I teach, so I'd appreciate the name of the common problem and a good way to correct it. Students frequently repeat the subject, first using a noun and then a pronoun, as in Oscar Wilde, he was a playwright.
That's a French construction, isn't it? It's a double subject.
Mm. It's a mistake, isn't it?
Yes.
In English?
You need only one subject. And you've reinserted another one in a pronoun form. Like, my brother, he beats me up.
Mm, that's not good.
No.
In two ways. Bad English and also,
yes,
I wish he'd
cruel.
Stop hitting
yes.
you. Okay. I hope that clears that one up. Steven says, I recently read a Sherlock Holmes novel where one of the male characters described a beautiful woman as handsome.
Uh-huh.
I don't think that most women in
right.
modern times would appreciate being described as handsome. Has the meaning of the word changed over time?
Yes. Handsome used to mean good-looking in a robust sort of way. You wouldn't call a tiny, delicate woman handsome, but you'd call a big, healthy woman handsome. And this wasn't a noun that was confined to men. Nowadays, we just use it for men. But back in the 19th century, it was perfectly natural. You
yeah.
still find it once in a while, somebody described as a...
Margaret Dumont.
Oh, yeah, a handsome woman. At least Groucho Marx thought so.
She
had
woman.
Her points.
Yeah.
Yes.
Marie from Queens. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello, how are you? I wanted to come back to the topic of the grammar of the ruling class and, the other dialects or variations that are spoken by the people who don't get to study the main language at university or whatever. And as it goes back in Europe, there were many dialects in many countries, very regional.
And, of course, with Marx, there were dialectics.
Excuse me.
And he was concerned about the working class.
Yeah.
Yes. So my particular question is, I saw a sample in the Bible Society's publication, 1937, of a book of samples when they had to translate the Bible into local dialects because the people couldn't read the King's English.
Mm-hmm.
And they sampled about 12 dialects in England, and one of them somewhat resembled the usages that turned up in the Black Southern English, and I'm wondering if it's known whether the Black Southern English derived from an English dialect rather than from proper spoken English and written English of the time, if you know anything about the origin of the speaking style of blacks in the South, from the time they were brought here and beyond.
When you said Black Southern English, I thought you meant in the south of England, but you mean,
I think she means Ebonics.
Right. I think you're talking about Black American Vernacular English. I can't really tell you how those accents evolved. This is a complicated question, and I'm not really qualified. It'd be more of a phonologist's question.
But there have been links shown between some southern dialects, in black and white, and rural English speech or older English speech of the people who may have come over in the 17th and early 18th century.
Right. And there are some common features of Black American English and the English spoken in England before about the late 18th century. But again, these are I'm not qualified to discuss.
I'm going to sneak in one more. This is something people ask all the
time.
Sorry. Kat asks about the use or misuse of the word nauseous. Her mother is a nurse who says that rather than saying I feel nauseous, you should say I am experiencing nausea or I feel nauseated, but recognizes by long and common use I feel nauseous is now acceptable. What do you think?
I think it's acceptable by now. It used to be one of those style things that you'd always find in style books. Nauseous / nauseated, and there would be a difference. Nauseous was something that was sickening, and nauseated means that you were sickened.
Mm-hmm.
But I think now that the distinction is probably all but gone.
And in the end, does it really matter grammatically?
I mean,
is nauseous a certain kind of a word?
This isn't really a grammar issue. It's more of a style and vocabulary and usage issue. And things like style, vocabulary, and usage are very, very fluid. Grammar is not fluid.
Patricia will be back with us on the 16th of February. Meanwhile, you can read any of her books, Woe Is I, You Send Me, Words Fail Me, Origins of the Specious, and you can also check her out on her website, which is grammophobia.com. You can also write to her at mailbox@grammophobia.com. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.